protecting ourselves, our companies, and our country against cyber attacks. The world is so connected right now in cyberspace, it is hard to really fathom. Everything from banking to electric grids, water companies to medical records, government agencies, schools, shopping, trains, airlines, you name it. The internet has made our world work more efficiently, but it also exposes us to new risks. As we've learned from the news over the past couple of years, hackers can target everything from retail stores to political campaigns. And identity thieves go after individuals and companies. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will look at the state of cybersecurity in 2017. Are we more or less vulnerable than we used to be? What can we be doing to protect ourselves? What does the future hold? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. There is that moment of panic when you hear about the latest cyber attack in the news, especially when it hits close to home. We've seen Anthem, Target, Maine General, Yahoo, and other systems all get breached, and we scramble to change passwords and secure our private information. On a larger scale, the alleged Russian hacking of our nation's election systems makes it all too real that cyber warfare is here and could be a worldwide threat. Are cyber attacks on the rise? What's being done to prevent them? And how can we as individuals protect ourselves? In the studio with me, Sari Green. She is the founder of Sage Data Security and a leader and author in the field of information security. And Edward Seiler. He's the technical director of the Maine Cybersecurity Cluster at the University of Southern Maine. And joining us on the line is Frank Appen. He is professor of information technology management at Thomas College, where he heads up the new Thomas Security Center. As always, we want to hear from you. Are you concerned about cyber attacks? Have you done anything to protect your private information? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Before, though, we discuss our cybersecurity, we want to briefly turn to Bruce Fitzgerald, who is the director of the Maine Emergency Management Agency, for an update on the storm. Bruce, thanks so much for joining us for just a few minutes. What are you hearing about out there? How is Maine faring in this giant snowstorm?
Yeah, it's been a busy day. We've been monitoring the conditions statewide. You know, the snow definitely was coming down hard this morning, and we're still seeing some pretty heavy snowfall in parts of the state, along with some high winds. The biggest issue really has been getting the roads clear and making sure that plow trucks can do their job safely and not encounter other vehicles on the road. So our big message for today really is to ask people, unless they have an emergency, to really stay home and stay off the roads if at all possible.
Bruce, it seems to me as though just about everything except for emergency folks, some restaurants and stores and some broadcast operations, everything else seems to be closed. We have Eastern Maine Medical Center closed except for emergencies, state government closed, schools. So it seems to me people are actually staying off the roads, aren't they?
I think so. And we're seeing that just about everywhere. I was just talking with somebody in Knox County earlier this morning, and it sounds like they were running into some traffic out on the road. So, and they seem to be kind of in the bullseye right now for the heaviest snowfall. So I just thought that given the opportunity here on your program, I'd ask people to stay home if they can.
What are we hearing about the regular things we hear with snowstorms? Are there very many accidents? Have there been very many power outages?
There have been a few accidents here and there, not probably as much as we expected, and that is because people are trying to stay off the road, so we appreciate everyone who is heeding that message. Power outages have been low this morning. They've crept up to maybe just over 1,200 as of right now, but I actually expected to see a lot more today, so I think we're doing pretty well. The snow is really light, and that helps, at least with all this wind, you don't have wet, sticky snow on the lines and the trees.
All right. Well, Bruce Fitzgerald, thanks so much for spending a few minutes with us here on Maine Calling. Bruce Fitzgerald is the director of the Maine Emergency Management Agency. And back to our topic of the day, which is cybersecurity. Edward Seiler, welcome back to Maine Calling. We always enjoyed the conversation when you're here. It seems to me that we're hearing more and more about cyber attacks in the news, both here in Maine and worldwide. Is that because we're learning about more of them? They're making the news, or is it because there are more of them?
Well, there certainly is a rise in reporting of them. The classic, the Russian hacks of the both the DNC and the RNC, and all that news is driving that. But we are all seeing some new things. The long-awaited arrival of using the Internet of Things to launch attacks. We saw the largest denial of service.
I'm going to stop you right there. That phrase, the Internet of Things, that is a phrase that I know that is a commonplace phrase in your world, but many people may not have heard it. What do you mean by the Internet of Things?
Plugging anything and everything into the network. Samsung, for example, has a refrigerator. You want to watch what's in your refrigerator, you can do it remotely over your phone. But it's also things like your DVR that connect and check licenses and enable you to watch what's recorded remotely. So all of that is networked. And because it's networked, you can get into it, if you're a bad guy, and use it to send malicious traffic to somebody you wish to do damage to.
So someone could send something as a small malicious thing, like turning off your refrigerator, if you have one of those fancy refrigerators, or a very large-scale malicious thing, like shutting down a power grid.
Shutting down a power grid, perhaps, but you'd more likely use, say, a camera within a power system as a point of access. So you've got a connected camera. You can connect into the camera remotely to control it, and then you can, what's called pivot, out and attack the power system. But you can also use hundreds of thousands of millions of those cameras to each send a little bit of data to a very, quote, robust server and knock it offline because it's overloaded. It's called a denial of service.
Okay.
When that goes on.
Sari, my understanding is that your company, Sage Data Security, helps companies and individuals protect themselves, correct?
We primarily work with companies, but we also do a lot of community education to assist for individuals.
So how easy is it when you are working with somebody who owns a company and comes to you kind of either very nervous or very nonchalant? What do you tell them? How easy is it to infiltrate a network?
So unfortunately, it's easier than one would hope. There are more attacks. Their attacks are getting much more brazen. They're getting much more sophisticated. And they're becoming more accessible. You can hire a hacker these days. You can just download an attack kit without having any type of coding skill. So certainly they are becoming more prevalent. So we talked to folks about the fact that there are really two types of attacks. There are targeted attacks. So an attacker is trying to get some intellectual property, perhaps, or for political reasons or military secrets. But the more common attack that's going to affect your listeners or our listeners are going to be opportunistic attacks. And an opportunistic attack is when the attacker, whether it's a cyber criminal or a cyber terrorist, is really out there scanning or probing the Internet for weaknesses. And those weaknesses could be technical weaknesses, but more often than not, they're going to be human weaknesses or human vulnerabilities. You know, if we go back to the DNC hack, you know, we had John Podesta's emails that were 60,000, I believe, Gmails that were exposed. But that all started from a phishing email. So a phishing email saying you need to change your Gmail password, that sort of passed scrutiny inside their organization. They said, yes, this is real. So they clicked on the link, gave up his password to, in this case, to the Russians, and that's the end of story. So that's all it took to actually go down that path.
Wow, that's scary.
It is scary.
I want to bring you into the conversation at Thomas College. Thomas College has started a new cybersecurity center. Why do you feel it's needed?
If we look at the need to defend ourselves from cybersecurity attacks, one of the key things is knowledge, but also experience. So we have a degree dedicated to cybersecurity, as well as options for other degrees. And the benefits of having the cybersecurity center is for students to do research, but also to gain experience. And it's in that light that we have an association or a memorandum of understanding with the Maine Emergency Management Association, Bruce was on earlier, and we are going out to municipalities in the state of Maine in a series of 26 weeks where we're giving installments to help smaller municipalities protect the information of citizens in Maine. And the benefit there is, first of all, to the citizens of Maine and their smaller towns, but also our students are getting experience communicating and sharing their knowledge in a safe way whilst everybody's benefiting. Once they leave us, they also have more experience to put to good use.
How many students at Thomas College are going into this field?
It's brand new. We've got our first graduates, but we're sitting at 37 students in the specialization.
Great. Frank Ed Seiler, I know you also work with students. Tell me about the Maine Cybersecurity Cluster, which you head.
Well, I'm the technical director.
Ray Albert. Right. one of the heads.
Yeah, Ray Albert is our Professor Ray Albert kindly came down from Fort Kent and has taken the directorship role. But we have students who work within our lab, run about 15 at any given time, giving them experiences. But we also do take the students out and get them used to educating the community, much like Frank is talking about. One of our students is actually putting together a week-long program for one of the local high schools. And how do you educate students around both safe surfing, but also make them, those high school students, able to educate their peers and not click on that and what to look for when somebody is perhaps trying to steal your password with phishing email, as Sari mentions.
Yeah, well, I want to get back to that phishing email, Sari, because all of us can imagine that happening to us. If something that looks legitimate from our email provider asks us, tells us that there's been some sort of breach and we need to change our password, we may do that. What do you advise people do if they get a message like that?
Delete it. I mean, they're not... Generally speaking, you're not going to be communicated via email. So if there was a major breach, you might get a letter. You may get an outreach from customer service. Again, you have to also be suspect of those as well.
You have to be suspect of phone calls especially, right? Yeah.
Of everything. So, I think, let's go back to something even more common. Maybe I get something from a retailer that says, here's a great coupon. If that coupon is going to be available, it will be available on their website as well. So I'm not going to click on the link in the email. I'm going to go to the website. I'm not going to give up any personal information. I am, as a consumer, when I get that, I'm not going to give up my social security number to anyone. My bank is not going to ask me information in that way. So I think that you have to be uber suspicious and hit the delete. Delete, delete, delete. It's very tempting to want to respond to those, but the answer is delete. And if it really is legitimate, the organization that needs to get in touch with you will find alternate ways to get in touch with you.
Okay. Frank Appen, I want to ask you about, you talked about working with small communities, towns and cities throughout Maine to help them protect themselves. What I'm wondering is, in some cases, is it possible that it's too late because so many different kinds of people have access to, say, a town's, the things that it needs to function on the internet?
Yeah.
Is there often a chance that one of those people has made a mistake and that town has already been compromised?
There have been a number of compromises, and some of those have been published, including things like a police department falling into a cyber attack by way of an email or clicking on something on a website. And the result was a ransomware attack. And that is where the data criminals make use of what you've done to plant a program that encrypts your whole hard drive so you cannot get your information. And then they expect a payment to release your data back to yourself. And one hopes that when one makes a payment like this, that they'll actually do it. So we see even small organizations, a town's police department, falling prey to this. And that comes back to what Sari said in terms of machines going out there and just looking for any opportunity. And you're no safer in Maine than any other location on the planet because the bad people are using machines to just try every and any address there is. So if we look at small towns having fallen prey to this, yes, they have. And in a smaller way, information could be lost because of the ability to do things. I know I helped a town some 10 years ago, and I was able to sit outside the town office with my notebook and do things inside the town office to illustrate their exposures. And that helped them become aware of their problem and more willing to do a few things to protect themselves.
So something as simple as locking your Wi-Fi is an important something that's important. You wanted to jump in, Sarah.
Yeah, I want to make sure that we're not all doom and gloom. You know, that there have been some really significant advances in cybersecurity over the past couple of years. We're seeing more awareness. We're seeing more controls put in place. There's a lot of investment in what the next technological controls can be to keep us safer. So I don't want everyone to say, oh, my God, I have to go shut off my, you know, get off the Internet, shut off my phone, not do any of this, because it's really risk-based decisioning. But I think one of the things to do when you're thinking about this whole this whole situation is to go back to this term of cyberspace that we used to use all the time, because it allows you to visualize what we're really talking about. You know, that cyberspace is just a metaphor that describes a non-physical terrain where our computer systems or our electronic devices communicate. And if you think about that as just a really big room, right, in the cyberspace is this non-physical terrain, but in it are people are doing fabulous things with music and mathematics and communication, but we've also got, you know, some bad folks in there, but we're all in this same room together and we're essentially holding hands. And so if you're thinking about how easy is it to get, you know, the criminal or to get the terrorist close to your system, think about the fact that you're actually in that room with them. And that's why we need to be so conscientious of the controls that we're going to put around our own systems and our own information, because they may be, you know, thousands of miles away, but they're really not. You know, metaphysically, they're inches away from you.
And Ed, I know we've talked about on Maine Calling's past how difficult it is sometimes for authorities to track these bad guys down. And I shouldn't say sometimes, most of the time. Is that changing? Is our ability to find the perpetrators improving?
A little bit. As you get more samples and you get a longer history, it's easier to trace people back. And actually, I was reading one of the online cybersecurity pieces, and they recently charged a gentleman, and actually he's in jail in California, as one of the largest spammers and purveyors of ransomware that Frank was talking about. So in that respect, we're improving, and the techniques are getting better. But if you've got somebody who is in a country where it is not actually a crime to do it, to, say, empty somebody's bank account, then how do you extradite them? What are you going to charge them with? There has been some luck occasionally tempting people to friendly countries. One of the guys who was sending heroin to people's houses in this country as a way to try to get them arrested managed to get busted in Italy. They had an arrest warrant created and tempted into Italy, and I believe he's been convicted and now serving time in one of the federal prisons. So that we're making some progress there, but it's still, you know, people can hide, but how good they are.
But, you know, that really circles us back to education, and not just community education, but the importance of the programs that are happening in the university system, at Thomas, and really all over the country, that what we really need is good, trained professionals. And there is such a spectrum of jobs that are open, from being very technical and doing a log analysis, perhaps, to risk-based business consulting. So I would really encourage, students who are kind of thinking, not quite sure what they want to do, to look at cybersecurity as a career. It's a fabulous career for both men and women. It's a very well-paying career, and there are literally tens of, thousands of job openings around the country and around the world.
Well, we do have to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions about cybersecurity. What are your questions? This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Goggin Energy, committed to helping you stay warm and comfortable with heat pumps for your home. Turn on the power of nature. GogginEnergy.com.
Electric car sales are on the rise, with new models offering longer range at lower prices.
Once you hit that accelerator, you go. So I think it'll put a smile on anyone's face.
Is this the moment they go mainstream? And will government support for clean cars continue?
The consensus is that nobody knows what the heck is going to happen next. Nobody.
Electric cars, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered this afternoon from 4 to 6:30 right here on Maine Public Radio. Thank you so much for supporting Maine Public Radio last week, our Super Thursday campaign, where we took just one day to take care of the business of public radio, is now history. 645 new contributors joined, and over $235,000 were raised in support of both Maine Public Radio and our new and growing Maine Public Classical Channel, bringing you more of the best of public radio, from the post-election transition and world events to great and relaxing classical music listening. Public Radio, Maine Public Radio, is here for you and because of you. Thanks. U.S. President Donald Trump and Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau will be holding a joint press conference following their visit at the White House this afternoon at 2 o'clock. Maine Public Radio will carry NPR special coverage of the press conference. The two leaders will make remarks and take questions. Join us for this special live coverage coming up at 2 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, cybersecurity. How bad are the threats and what can be done about them? With me in the studio, Edward Seiler, who is Technical Director of the Maine Cybersecurity Cluster at USM. Sari Green is here, too. She's the founder of Sage Data Security and Information Security Expert. And joining us on the line, Frank Appen, Professor of Information Technology Management at Thomas College and head of the Thomas Security Center. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Before the break, we were talking about how many job opportunities there are for someone who might major in or become an expert in cybersecurity. I want to ask you, Frank, what makes a good candidate for a cybersecurity major? What kids are you looking for?
Surprisingly, a lot of students think that if they like computer games, they are destined for this. And that's true, but we also need to remember that it is quite logic-bound and that math comes into it. So we find that those students do actually do well, although they're surprised how hard they have to work. What we're trying to do, as well as many of the large businesses and state government, is to reach out to the general school population and identify the opportunities. To put it in context, if we look at 2013, where we read in Security Week that there were 209,000 vacancies, we now have Frost and Sullivan coming up with research saying there are going to be 1.8 million vacancies. And if one adds to that that the younger students face a world where things are changing and rapid promotions are quite common, with 28% jobs churn. What we see for our student population is an ability to have an excellent career. And very often one can start off with that career right here from Maine. A recent graduate, December graduate of our cybersecurity program, is working in Portland and about to go off to engagements in Missouri and Alaska whilst living in Maine. I've had others in my classes, other classes, that worked with teams overseas and locally, but lived in Maine. So the opportunity in this arena is that there are so many vacancies. The amount of income that you can get is very significant. And one can satisfy your career needs without needing to go around and move your family. It's a wonderful opportunity, although I do highlight it's not easy, as in one doesn't have to do things like logic, a little bit of programming, and some math. But I highlight that with application, anyone can do that.
And I'm going to ask, too, if people who are listening who might be mid-career and have a chance, Sarah, you're nodding, and I'm guessing that when you went to college, there was not a cybersecurity major offered to you.
There wasn't computers offered to me. I think it's a great mid-career change. You know, we do need the technical folks and the math skills, but there are also social skills. You know, we have hired English majors who have an interest in cyber and have business experience and can put those pieces together, because cyber isn't just about the technology part. It's also about policy. It's about education. It's about risk management. It's a very, very broad field. And I do want to echo what was just being said about hiring locally. We've hired a number of graduates from the Fort Kent program. We've had an excellent program over the years and have used interns from them. At Sage, we really want to hire, Maine graduates, and so we are looking forward to all of these programs that are being developed. So there are jobs certainly right in the state.
All right, we're going to go to the phone, so we'll go to Mike, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Mike, go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Yeah, hi. I'm not quite sure how to frame this question. I guess it's like this. Given the potential that has so increased exponentially and continues to do so, the absolute power of the Internet and the Internet of Things, and, all of this stuff that we really can't even comprehend anymore as human beings, I think, that's all increased. What hasn't increased is our ethics or our morals. And so here we are presented with something like fire and TNT and everything else all combined into one, really, as far as pure potential goes. And it's nice to talk about all these security measures, but, I haven't found anybody that can really talk me off the ledge about the inevitability of a real grand crash caused by somebody doing something bad simply because of this unleashed power that we really can't control. So talk me off the ledge.
Okay, thanks, Mike. Ed, do you think that something big is going to happen?
Well, we have seen it. For example, the Ukrainians actually had their power grid invaded by the Russians and knocked off, taken offline. On the other hand, you can recover from that a little bit. And it wasn't offline permanently. Repairs were required, and things were brought back up. So you really can't end up back in the dark age. And in terms of the issue around people's ethics and that evolving area, it's actually become fairly robust. So, for example, should I discover a flaw in Maine Public's website, there's a well-established within the hacker community protocol where I would get in touch with Maine Public and say, hey, I found this long before I claim Count Coup on it. Now, there's also the implied threat that if Maine Public doesn't fix it within a certain amount of time, I get to claim Coup and tell everybody how I did it, and Maine Public is exposed.
But you are potentially an ethical hacker.
Right. So it's my I get to claim it after it's fixed. So I get the benefit and the social standing in my hacker community of, yes, I discovered this flaw, but I haven't actually exposed any damage. Some companies, such as Google, I believe Apple as well, now pay bounty. If you find a flaw and you report it to them, they look down and say, oh, yeah, this is reasonably serious. We'll write you a check for tens. I think Google has now paid out over $100,000 to one individual for a serious flaw in their equipment that they discovered, revealed to Google, and Google dealt with.
Here's a related Facebook post. This is from Philip. That's not the one I meant to read. Here we go. Lots of emails. This one's from Richard. Can your guests comment on the vulnerability of, one, the U.S. power grid, and, two, the U.S. nuclear arsenal to cyber attack? Could the grid go down from cyber attack? Could nuclear warheads be detonated by cyber attack?
So I want to back up a minute to get our other caller off the ledge with an assurance that there are a lot of very, very devoted cyber professionals across the country who are working extremely hard to protect our organizations and to protect our country. We have a lot of talent out there, and that we are getting more visibility, both in the corporate environment, all the way up to the boardroom, as well as in government. So while there seems to be this exponential increase in threats, there is this corresponding increase in defense in debt mechanisms and folks that are working very hard to protect us. So I don't think it's inevitable that there's going to be a major attack. Could there be? Are there weaknesses in the power grid? Yes. Are there potentially weaknesses in the nuclear environment? Sure, because ultimately when we're connected into this one big network, there is certainly the potential. But there are a lot of stopgaps, and there are a lot of controls all along the way and people who are looking at those controls.
I could add to that.
Sure.
If we look at the two together, we have a lot of resources available, and many organizations aren't aware of them. The Department of Homeland Security, together with organizations like InfraGuard, provide very specialized information sources. They talk about the 16 critical infrastructures. Banking and the power grid are all part of that, as well as a special section for nuclear reactors, materials, and waste. And InfraGuard, as an example, has a complete outreach, and together with Ed, we're actually activating Maine to get information here and information electronically to any organization in Maine that cares to join. So there are very specific programs, depending on your area, where you can get the best information funneled to you locally. And no, they're not going to come and fix yours. That's where you go and knock on Cyrus' door. But you can certainly get the information, and it is shared openly and freely to give you an idea of where we're going and what we have. To take the most recent question, is there an opportunity for something to go wrong? By completely isolating oneself from the Internet, one can take your most critical items and provide far more safety than one can find in other ways. If we look at the electric grid, is there a chance that someone could find a hole somewhere and do some damage or create a lack of service for a period? I think that's possible, but is it going to be long-term? Is it going to be a situation where we can't fix it? I'd come back to Ed's comment and say, it might be inconvenient for a bit, but we have enough going that we can do a reasonable job of reversing a problem like that fairly quickly. And, for example, there are specific tests where people say, how can we destroy this? And they actually take a big generator and say, what can we do to it? And they test it, and they learn from that. So we've improved a lot in some of the areas. We accept some risk for convenience and for the ability to share and be open. But I think the most sensitive areas are well locked up.
Here's the question for Philip on Facebook. What are the steps we can take to protect our information online as well as email communications and messaging? Are encrypted email and messaging platforms effective? And are password security apps like iPassword effective? Or is it 1Password effective?
Well, encryption... great. Wonderful. Please do it. Encrypted email means that it can't be read as it passes from one machine to another. On the other hand, if it's sitting in a copy on somebody's local desktop and they get in, they can pick it up there. So you're really, with encryption, protecting that information in flight. Tools like 1Password, KeePass, LastPass, all sorts of these out there, yes, they're effective. They're a great idea. I encourage people to use them. Also, setting an incredibly hard password that you then have to reset. So in effectively getting a system of what's called multi-factor authentication, where you have to ask for your password to be reset. You have to have the password into the email system to collect that. It's on a machine that is known to whatever the vendor is a great thing. And I would, on the multi-factor authentication, encourage people who are using online or in the cloud email systems, if they can take advantage of that, to do it. And that's where, when you log in, your email provider sends you a text message with a number in it that you've got to type in and verify that you are who you say you are.
Simply changing your passwords a couple times a year is a lot better than not doing isn't it?
Absolutely. Yes. First thing, change password.
But the problem is it takes a lot of time. I decided to do that after one of these programs, and it was a major commitment. It took me several hours because we don't realize how many things we have passwords for and how many of those things may have credit card information on them.
Oh, yeah.
Go ahead.
If one looks at that, these password tools are wonderful because you, as a human, aren't going to remember all those nasty passwords. You don't want to write them down. And these tools are very convenient. They also allow you to move your passwords around as long as you do that safely. It's this inventory of safety that you've got to think about. Is my garage door opener a threat to me? Should I have a camera on the internet? Should my front door be on the internet? And if I do so, have I done it safely? If I've got an email account that tells me about a password on my bank account changing, have I got that email well secured? So very often there are tools available, as long as you may be a little suspicious and take some care in what you do, and you literally change a bad position into something good. An example is, well, credit cards on the internet aren't safe. Well, your bank might offer you a one-time use credit card number that will get allocated to one company for a fixed period and for a fixed amount of money. And I've suddenly turned internet purchases to being far safer than buying gas or using my credit card at the restaurant. So there are a number of small things that we can do to make significant gains in reducing our risk.
I just want to emphasize on your email, particularly if you're a Gmail user, to set up two-factor authentication that was just mentioned. Your email is really the gateway to so many of your other accounts. So if you have, for example, an Amazon account and you forget your password, right, it's going to send you an email to go change your password. So if the criminal can get into your email, they effectively can pass through into lots of other accounts that you have. So as soon as this program is over, you go back to your system, go to your Gmail and get two-factor authentication.
And by two-factor, it means when you have a security question or something like that?
No, in this case, two-factor will be a very different factor. So they will send you a text message. So you'll get a text message with a code, and then you will put that code in. And you can say, you don't have to do it on this computer only every 30 days if you want to do it that way. I think you should do it all the time. But I think, securing your email is absolutely critical. Certainly encryption is good. But there's also some individual responsibility in protecting our own privacy and thinking about what information you're giving up. When you are filling a form online, who are you giving your birth date to? Or who are you giving a social security number to when you go to the doctor's office and they give you a form to fill out? Do they really need that information? So I think we all have an individual responsibility to think about the information that we choose to share and to be just more conservative with that.
Okay, well, we do have to take another break. When we return, more of your comments and questions. Please stay with us.
Advertisers and marketers already track our shopping behavior online, but businesses are now tracking our behavior elsewhere through apps on our phones.
They track how you're walking through the store, where you are, and can even change the price on goods.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Joseph Turo about his new book, The Aisles Have Eyes. Join us.
Join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 here on Maine Public Radio.
Later today on This American Life, animal lovers love wild seals on a beach near San Diego, but they disagree on how close to the seals they should get, and it is not bringing out a good side of people.
So you're spitting on me now, huh?
I didn't touch you.
You spit on me.
You're harassing me.
You spit on me.
I spit on your camera.
How great we are dealing with nature later today.
You can hear This American Life this evening at 11 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio. U.S. President Donald Trump and Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau will be holding a joint press conference following their visit at the White House this afternoon at 2 o'clock. Maine Public Radio will carry NPR special coverage of the press conference. The two leaders will make remarks and take questions. Join us for the special live coverage coming up in just a few minutes at 2 o'clock right here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling today on the program Protecting Against Cyber Attacks. Joining me today, Frank Appen, who is head of the new Security Center at Thomas College, and Sari Green, who is the founder of Sage Data Security. Do you say data or data? I've always wondered.
You say data, I say data.
And Edward Seiler with the Maine Cybersecurity Cluster at USM. Join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. We were talking a little bit during the break. I have been told, and this was a surprise to me years ago, but I have noticed how many people do it since, the worst thing you can do is have something on your desktop that's labeled passwords and put all your passwords in this. And Ed's laughing, but why? Why is that not good? Somebody might think, well, what's the problem? It's on my desktop. It's not on the internet.
Well, so when you go to get rid of that machine or the hard drive dies, I occasionally buy used computers and I find those files on that say passwords. And it'll say this bank account, this user ID, this password. Gee, that's very helpful to me as a cyber criminal. I can get in and do what I want. Then you get things like ransomware that lock up your system, and you could lose all of your passwords if you're unwilling to pay. And that if you don't have that file stored on there, then maybe you just tell the crook, hey, I'm not willing to pay because so what? I don't have any data that I can't recover.
So if you're not if you don't feel comfortable using one of these programs you were talking mm-hmm. about earlier, like 1Password, really the best thing to do is to write your passwords in a little booklet or on a piece of paper and put it somewhere in your home.
Well, and funnily enough, it actually makes sense for like your home router to write the password on the router because you don't want it reset to the defaults that are published on the net. If there's a problem and your spouse needs to get into your router, there's the password rather than having to say reset it and now it's got to be it's now open effectively.
And you were also saying that you recommend people have 2 email addresses.
That's correct. One is that published public, the one that comes in, the one that's on the phone, that's where you expect all the emails, and then the one that's attached to the bank accounts and everything else. And because what you're going to get is those phishing emails are going to arrive in your public published one. And you can say, oh, yeah, there's no way American Express is getting in touch with me here. That's not the account that's attached to American Express.
Great. We're going to go to Wyndham and Erica. Hi, Erica. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm a volunteer with the AARP Fraud Watch Network. And through this work, I've become more and more familiar with a number of cyber attacks. I was wondering if the panelists could talk about the dangers of using public Wi-Fi.
Do you all? If you're in a coffee shop, do you use the public Wi-Fi?
No.
No.
No. We've got 3 no's. What about just to read the newspaper?
No.
No? Not even that, huh?
Well, I think it also depends the device you're going from, right? So if you have a device that has anything that you need to keep secure on it, or you're doing any type of communication that you'd want secure, you don't want on a public Wi-Fi because, well, it's public. And by its very nature, that means it can be connected to by anyone who has access to that network.
The other thing is that you're never quite sure what you're connected to. I can set up a public Wi-Fi that is Starbucks with a dollar sign rather than an S and fool you into connecting it, at which point I control where you're going. So you may think you're logging into Bangor Savings Bank, but you're actually logging into my website.
Oh, gosh. Frank, okay, you're stuck in an airport for 6 hours, and you've got your laptop with you. You don't use the Wi-Fi?
No, I have my work prepared, and I work on my laptop, but I avoid connecting. If I do want to connect to something, I will use a public computer and go to an open email account that I have that has got no security stuff, but people can contact me. And then I'll make a phone call if I need to.
Oh, my. Okay, so what I want to ask now, and I guess I'll send this to you, Sari, if people are listening to this program today and think, the top of my head has just come off, and all these things I do usually I'm learning are not good things to do, is there a good resource source? Is there somewhere people can go to sort of slowly absorb this information, think about how he or she does things, think about changing passwords? Is there some place on the internet you recommend?
There actually are. You know, the number of the government agencies do have good publications. that are consumer-based. And what I can do is get you a list, and we can put it on the
That'd
Facebook
be terrific.
Page.
The Maine Calling Facebook page. We'll watch for that later this afternoon. We're going to go. Erica, thanks so much for your call. Larry in Bangor. Hi, Larry. Go ahead.
Hi. I guess three quick things. I use 1Password, very much like it. To the gentleman who said he found the flaw in your system, MPM traces you more than any place else I know of. And finally, the program they have at the University of Maine routinely wins competitions wherein they're trying to break into various systems.
Okay.
The collegiate level, they have competition, and University of Maine routinely.
What do you mean by follow? When you said Maine Public follows you, what does follow mean?
You have more things that try to get a hold of my address than any other page I've ever been to.
Okay, so Ed, you're looking confused there. You first of all, to clarify, you were using, you were not saying that you had hacked Maine Public's website. You were using an analogy, right?
Yes. No, I've never attacked Maine Public's website. But I'm curious, are you talking about cookies? Are you talking about getting emails or what
there
do you
are, There are cookies that are cookies. Then there are cookies that try to keep in your system and tell MPBM everything you've done. Well, tell MPBM where you've gone, things like that. MPBM traces you all the time. As soon as you get off their site, they seem to be dropped. At least my program that drops cookies always finds them gone. But as soon as I'm on your site again, they are just eager to find out everything I'm doing.
Well, one of the natures of the way the web works, in particular HTTP and HTTPS, is that you have to use cookies to maintain persistence, so you know where somebody is within a site. As I'm not a member of the technical staff here, I don't quite know what's going on there.
Larry, yeah, and I'd really recommend that you call someone on our fantastic technical staff, because this is something that Maine Public takes very, very seriously, and I'm very surprised to hear what you're saying to us over the air on the radio when it's something I've never heard working here for 10 years. So I really recommend that you call and talk to our technical staff. So with that, we're going to move along. I want to sort of broaden this out a little bit in the few minutes we have left, Sari, and talk about some of this sort of international security. I think a lot of people are really, really concerned about what we're hearing, especially what we heard after the campaign, the possibility that someone inside Russia, perhaps the Russian government, perhaps someone else, was able to somehow try to manipulate something going on in the United States government. What are your thoughts on this? Is this, one, do you believe that this is true, that this kind of cyber hacking is going on between nations, and what we're going to see in the future?
So certainly the cyber hacking between nations is true, and it is happening, whether it's the Russians or the Chinese, and it's not new. It's been happening for quite a while. I think there's this real – certainly we need to be concerned about national security and our civic duty as an individual, and I think there's a direct line between national security and our personal devices, and whether they're the at-home devices, the IoT devices that we were just talking about, like your refrigerator or your thermostat or your handheld device or your laptop. One of my concerns now is it really deals with the weaponization of those devices, that if we allow those devices to be utilized by our adversaries, they can be used literally as weapons to attack us. You mentioned earlier denial of service, where a number of computers are going to ask for a resource so much that it overloads the resource. So I think that we all have an individual responsibility to protect our systems and keep our systems secure. And so very quickly, what does that mean? That means that setting our systems up for automatic patching so that patches come down and keep our address any vulnerabilities that our systems might have, making sure that we are securing our wireless networks, ensuring that we're not directly connected to the internet, but we're doing it through a firewall. I mean, there's just some very basic hygiene that all of us can do, both as individuals and in our corporate environment, to secure our systems so they don't become weapons in the hands of our adversaries.
Frank, do you have anything to add to that?
I'd agree, and it comes back to people. If we think about security being people, products, and processes, people are their weakness. I wrote my doctoral dissertation on people in Maine, working with hospitals, part of the state, and a bank. And one can actually gauge the pulse of how safe would my people keep me. And one would do the same in your home. Are we a little suspicious? We never take a default password. We update our passwords. We have complicated passwords. And we have some prized assets. That might be the phone that gives you text messages, the email that has your bank account numbers, or the piece of paper that you might have written. Those are all prized assets that you want to protect and know where they are, pretty much as a male would always know when their wallet isn't in their pocket. And that brings us to a much safer space, and that applies to global cyber warfare, which is a class I teach at a few universities. And yeah, there's bad stuff going on, but we can do so much to improve ourselves.
And Ed, I'm going to end with you. How does the U.S., I guess the word would be rank, compared to the rest of the world in protecting ourselves?
I think we're actually in pretty good shape. And a couple reasons for that. One, we have a very robust tech sector that's out trying to do these things. Secondly, we're fairly open about it. And we're trying to be more open about the discussion and revealing the flaws. And the faster you find the flaws, the faster you can fix the flaws, the faster you can respond to an attack. And thirdly, we have good intellectual property laws. So the theft of devices and operating systems and that intellectual property is protected. And therefore, going after the bad guys is an option.
All right. Well, thank you all for joining us today. It's a big topic, I know, and if you're not right in the middle of it, a whole lot to take in. Ed Seiler, the technical director of the Maine Cybersecurity Cluster at the University of Southern Maine. Frank Appen, professor of Information Technology Management at Thomas College. He leads the new Thomas Security Center. And Sari Green is the founder of Sage Data Security and a leader and author in the field of information security. Nikki Shields ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling as well as a link to our audio archives by visiting mainecalling.net. Today's show will be rebroadcast again tonight at 8. It is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn, and we will get those links on our Maine Calling Facebook page just as soon as we can. Tomorrow on the program, join me for a Valentine to the diversity of performing arts organizations across our region. Excuse me, Keith Shortall will be hosting tomorrow. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.